Today's guest on Brio TV, the podcast, has sold more duct tape than any other guest. Plus, he looks great in plaid and always knows how to keep his stick on the ice. Join me today for a great conversation with a Canadian Comedy Hall of Famer. Well, hi again, and as listeners here know, I admire anyone who can get a show on the air in this country with all the funding and network scheduling hurdles. Cranking out actual CanCon is one of the seven tasks of Hercules. My guest today created a character in a series that he exported all over Canada and the States in a series he held together with duct tape and talent for 16 consecutive seasons. And that was after creating several other shows. This month, he's being honored in Hamilton, Ontario, a place where he created this series, by being inducted into the Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame. Please give a warm Possum Lodge welcome to my hero, Red Green himself, Steve Smith.
I was going to say, the last time I saw you was, I think that'd be 30 years ago at our house in Hamilton, I think.
Yeah, a long time ago. My God, you know... Yeah, over the years, I mean, I was working for TV Guide, and I think the first time I came to the Comedy Mill and met everybody. So that was a few years ago for sure. But
Late 80s.
Yeah, so it was always a thrill and a pleasure. And while we're waiting, I had time to catch up on my reading. I'm moving, so I haven't moved all the books off the shelf. This is a very funny book, Red Green's Beginner's Guide to Women. I just love that. They actually Doubleday put duct tape on this line. Honestly, a very funny book. I laughed out loud the first time I read it, and I can't believe it's been available for 10 years. People need to grab that copy if they can. It's a funny read.
No, thank you, Bill.
Steve, listen, we're talking because, we were due to talk, and I'm glad we are. But you're being honored by the Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame. Did you even know there was a Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame, Steve?
No. There's a quick answer. Not a clue.
That makes you like most Canadians, but here it is. And now they're moving you in. They're honoring you as both a builder and a performer, which I think is really important. You're going in at the same time as Marie Dressler. Steve,
that's big, man.
Hey, you know, she was the biggest star in Hollywood in 1930-31 or so. So that's pretty good.
I think I was in grade 5 with her.
I'll just keep serving them up, okay? But other folks, Jim Carrey, the cast of SCTV, so they're catching up with some great comedy names. But congrats to you. I think this is so wonderful, and I think I've told you this before, but you're one of my heroes in TV Canada and Canadian television. Mm-hmm. Covering this industry, I know the miracle it is to get one show on the air, and you did it. I think outside the usual lanes, you know, normally related to someone on the CRTC or the funding agencies. You joined the NHL and you hadn't even skated yet, you know. So my hat's off to you because you created so much television and so much very funny television. And I think 300 episodes of the Red Green Show is astounding. I mean, that's I think that beats the Beachcombers, right? So
well, it wasn't as funny as the Beachcombers.
Not every week, maybe. Okay.
But Bill, you say that stuff, but you know, I read a book about, you know, branding is in the early 80s, and one of the questions in it was, is it better to be a big fish in a small pond or a small fish in a big pond? And the answer for them was, be a big fish in a small pond and then increase the size of the pond. And that's exactly what was my approach to Canadian television. I mean, I was doing the show out of CHCH TV in Hamilton.
Yeah.
Not only did they not have a clue what I was doing, they didn't care. Apathy became my biggest asset. And I got to the CBC a little bit because the CBC wanted the show, but mainly because they wanted the audience. And so I was able to increase the size of the pond. That's how that worked out.
Well, not only that, but you jumped across the pond. You were on, I don't know, 100 PBS affiliates. And had quite an impact there. I used to love your pledge. PBS would have a pledge drive, and yeah. Red Green would go on. What was it you would urge viewers to do in terms of sending money?
Well, I'd say, you know, if you like the show, send in a little bit of money. And if you don't like the show, send in a lot of money so they can afford to buy something better.
That is a brilliant line. My favorite
promo ever for the show was, you know, watch the Red Green show when you've already wasted most of your life with another half hour.
that's the right approach. I think it's tremendous. Where did you find your funny bone? Were you from? Were your parents had a great sense of humor, or growing up? Where did your sense of humor come from?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't remember either one of my parents as you know, being really funny or anything. Things always occurred to me that didn't occur to other people, and the normal things didn't occur to me. So it wasn't any conflict. And I had the same teacher for grades 6, 7, and 8. In public school, and she said no one's allowed to speak out in class except him. And so I could say whatever I thought because it was funny, but it wasn't disruptive. I wasn't trying to destroy what she was doing. It made it more entertaining, and that was a huge thing. I look back at that. That was the first indication that maybe this is something I should pursue.
I think Jim Carrey has said that when he was in school, around the same age, that the teacher finally said, look, we'll wait till Friday and you'll have the last 15 minutes. I'm trying to remember it, but that seems like wise words, you know, teachers realizing there was an opportunity there for you and for them. Where did you spend your growing up years?
I was in Toronto until I was maybe 13. Yeah. I went to first year of high school, went to Royal York Collegiate, and I was 12 going to, I remember the first day because I had skipped and my birthday is in December. So I was already sometimes 2 years younger. The guy in the locker beside me, he was a man. He was in my class. So he was 15. I was 12. And on the first day, he said to me, you know, if I wanted to, I could kill you. And I, you know, Bill, I didn't question it. You know, I decided, what can I do so that he won't want to kill me? Well, I made him laugh. You know, I spent a year making him laugh and saved my own life.
Wow. Well, that's eventually he could drive you to school, probably, I
guess. Yeah. We moved away at the end of grade 9. We moved to Brandon. So at the end of that.
There you are. But almost to me, more important than even being funny is having such determination. I just, again, Canadian television, you really need to stick it out. And where did that come from, Steve?
I'm a very persistent person. I have a huge, massive ego that says I can figure out how something works and make it work to my advantage. So to quit on something is just such a defeat to me that I'd be lost for the rest of my life. So I just, whatever the heck it is, if it's a jigsaw puzzle or I'm fixing a car or whatever I'm doing, I believe in myself. I believe I can solve this thing if I just get a little more information or work a little bit harder. So that's what I'm stuck with.
Well, no, hats off to you. That's what it takes. Was Smith & Smith your first television venture?
Yeah, it was. My wife and I had like a touring duo. We were like the Canadian Sonny and Cher, and we just couldn't find anywhere to fit. We didn't really fit in a bar, although we did okay in some little Irish type. But this Hall of Fame ceremony is at what used to be called Hamilton Place, and that was really our first big break. We got to open for Al Martino.
Wow.
It had to be fall of 76, something like that, and in the audience, unbeknownst to us, was the general manager of CACH, and that's, you know, what got us the pilot, and away we go.
Amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Basically, so were you mainly a folk duo? What was the music you were singing, you and Morag, your wife at the time?
You know, she was the singer, but I was writing all the stuff, and I would do like satirical type things, or even original melodies. You know, remember that guy, Mark Russell, I think his name was, played the piano, you know, and sing about politics. Well, it was a little bit like that. I played the guitar, and we'd sing things about, you know, traveling on an airline and losing your bags, that kind of stuff, you know? So it was folk. I would say it was folk based, but the comedy was in there as well.
You know, when you look at this, this Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame, they're honoring a few other people from that have a Hamilton connection as well this year. Eugene Levy, of course.
Yeah.
Short, you, I think there might even be one other, but what is it about? Is something in the water in Hamilton, something other than ore or minerals from the smelting or something? What is it?
You know, I think that there's a sense of oppression in Hamilton. It's the blue-collar city. And even if you look across the world, some of the oppressed cultures, you know, Scotland or Ireland or whatever, they have tremendous comedy in those. That's the way they deal with it. So I think it makes sense that you know, if you don't have everything that you think you should have, you kind of laugh about it rather than
your
brains out.
Yeah, no, you're honest. I grew up in Etobicoke. I always thought that's a far too comfortable place.
Yeah.
That's why I moved to Brampton. But anyway, now we're moving again. But listen, so are you going to be involved in the ceremonies? Are you coming up for the February festivities where they're honoring you?
Yeah, I am. I'm flying up, and I'm going to bring my kids and my grandkids. I got six grandchildren now, and so it's going to be just a great family celebration. I'm honored. Like I said, at first when I heard about it, I thought this can't be real and everything. And Jeff Lumby, who's a guy I'm still working with, he phoned me from France to tell me what a deal this was. So I thought, but if he's phoned me from France, I should probably go. He's going there too. So, and McKenna will be there. It's going to be great. Graham Greene's coming. It's going to be good.
Oh, that's fantastic. Why is it France is always the first? They knew about Jerry Lewis and Red Green.
We'll forgive them for Jerry Lewis.
Exactly. Who are your heroes in Canadian television or comedy when you were starting out? Were there people you thought, I want a career like that guy? Or,
well, you know, one of the inductees, Billy Van, I mean, that House of Frankenstein, I thought it was so good, I thought it was American.
Yeah, I was, I think, you know, 25 before I figured out he played all those roles, right?
And he would do it, they would just let it roll all night. He'd do that, you know, right through the night. It's just crazy stuff.
Yeah, and he had a career in the 60s. Nightcap, I think, was a sort of a late-night comedy show.
Paul Soles.
Paul Soles, absolutely.
Dinah Christie.
Yes. Well, Party Game, right?
Party Game, Captain Jack Duffy.
Were you ever, I guess that was ran through the 70s. That was before.
That was before me, yeah.
Right. You could have been on the couch with Captain Jack Duffy.
I could have been.
Yeah. Back with Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame inductee, Steve Smith, in just a moment. Time once again to check in with our friend Emily Gagné at Hollywood Suite. Emily, Happy New Year. What do you got for us now?
Well, Bill, we're blasting off into 2024 with genre fair. We're talking sci-fi, we're talking horror, we're talking the freakiest and the most fun movies you can think of. Everything from Beetlejuice to Blade, we've got on our channels this month.
Wow, Blade scares me. What's the freakiest sci-fi film you've got, though?
Sci-fi? I mean, we've got 2001 A Space Odyssey. I don't know if that's the freakiest, but it's a classic. We've got Close Encounters of the Third Kind. But I really think if you want something weird and wonderful, we have this film called 976 Evil, which is directed by Freddy Krueger himself, Robert Englund.
Well, that's the number, 976 Evil. You can find it on Hollywood Suite. Emily, thanks for the tip.
Thanks, Bill.
Well, did you know that it was June Carter Cash who wrote one of Johnny Cash's biggest hits, Ring of Fire? That's just one of the things you'll learn watching June, streaming this month on Paramount Plus. June shines a spotlight on the history of country music and the Carter and Cash families. The five-time Grammy Award-winning singer, actor, and author has opened for Elvis, appeared on screen with Robert Duvall and Jane Seymour, and as mentioned, was a damn fine songwriter. Featuring interviews with the woman herself, the film also includes sit-downs with her family, admirers, and friends, including Dolly Parton, Reese Witherspoon, and Willie Nelson. And remember, there's a mountain of premium entertainment for audiences of all ages on Paramount Plus. And we're back with Steve. Well, okay, let's talk about, so you, after Smith & Smith, you do Me and Max, I think, with your family, with the kids.
Yeah.
And you then you do The Comedy Mill, which was a pretty ambitious show, more ambitious than the budget, probably.
Always.
But you had this flowering of this talent there that it was like a hothouse for Linda Cash and Peter Callahan.
Yeah, yeah.
Mag
Ruffman,
Mag was very, very funny. And from that came the character of Red Green, right?
No, character of Red Green started on Smith & Smith.
Oh,
1978.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I was making fun of Red Fisher. I would sit on a picnic table and just keep talking until I thought of something, you know, and that's, and away we go.
Well, and Red Fisher, for those who may not know, is this guy. Yeah. For 20 years, he would go fishing and he'd have a celebrity pal, often a Toronto Maple Leaf or something, and they would go.
Ted Williams was his buddy, too.
Ted Williams, my God.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Famous Hall of Fame slugger. So, get in a boat and it would be 16 millimeter film and then some commentary, which you spun into a lot of brilliant segments on on Red Green.
And he wrote poems too, so that's why I had the poetry in the Red Green Show. That was a salute to him as well.
So you were just hypnotized by that show. You know, when you saw it, did you think there's something that's screaming for parody? Like, what was the connection?
Yeah, I mean, to me, he had the attitude that nothing would bore you, and I thought that was fascinating. So, my approach to Smith & Smith was, it's 100% filler. So, you know, whatever you want to do, just go ahead and do it. And the funny thing, Bill, was, you know, I started that character, like I say, in 78. And by the time I developed it into the actual Red Green Show and then had a live audience starting in season 3, I could feel the audience forcing this thing that started as a caricature into a character. There was, when I said something or did something that in their minds, Red Green would never say or do, you could feel it, and then I would adjust, you know. So they really helped me create something that had a lot more legs than the initial satire.
My memory, when I interviewed you once, you said that when you started the Red Green Show at CHCH, it was almost like something you had in your bag. It was handy. Let's go with this until I think of the big thing I'm going to do. Am I off base or?
No, you're right on the money. And it was a reaction to Comedy Mill, where Telefilm approached us to do something. You're the kind of talent we should be supporting. So that's what got us into that and got the funding and everything. And then they said, oh, by the way, you can't do anything that you've ever done before. It has to be totally unlike anything you've ever done before. So they wouldn't let us do what we had success with. That was because they were afraid broadcasters were just going to dip into the fund to just subsidize what they were going to do anyway. You know what I mean?
Right.
So that, yeah, and that was not a happy experience for me. So I just wanted to, let's bring it down to, you know, let's just live off the grid for a little while. And Rick Green and I, who'd been writing together for, you know, probably 18 years by then, wow, thought, well, let's do something. It'll get us through 6 months, and then we'll just find something else to do.
Amazing. It's
been a long 6 months.
It has been. Rick was one of the Frantics, of course, before that, and right, was in a lot of these black and white segments on the Red Green Show, where he's trying crazy stuff in your commentary. I always enjoyed that part of it. It was kind of a throwback, like a slapsticky silent movie stuff, right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And we had found a piece of music. It was like National Film Board documentary music. Perfect, so contrasting what was going on the screen. And when we shot those, I went to there was a you're not going to believe it, an antique hairdressing salon. I don't know. They sold antiques and they would do your hair, and it was in Burlington. And they had a Umig camera, the kind you wind up. So I bought the camera, 16 mil, and I bought the little reels of film. They were like 3-minute reels.
Yeah.
So I think when we did the first one, and then I went and had the film developed, it was 5 reels, and 3 of them were color and 2 of them were black and white. Well, what am I going to do with that? They're all part of the same thing. I'm not Ted Turner. I couldn't afford to colorize the black and white ones. So I just made them all black and white, and people say, oh, that's so brilliant that you
so smart. Yeah, I know. I had an old Bolick 16 millimeter.
Oh, sure, same thing. Yeah,
my dad had an old camera, made home movies that way, and that's how I got into that. But you had to wait for it to be developed before you could edit it, right? And it's so hard to explain to people today when they can do all this on their phone.
On their phone.
Right?
I know. And you do a take and you think, did we get that? Well, I think so. You can't look at it. You know?
Right. Yeah. Do you think, Steve, I mean, if you were starting out with this idea today, would it start out on TikTok, or, you know, would you do it as a YouTube show? What do you think?
Well, the situation today is a double-edged sword. First of all, you have incredible access to the world that you never had. When I was coming on, there's a gatekeeper at every broadcaster, and some person who has failed in everything they've tried to produce. So now they're going to tell you what works.
Yeah. Just like telefilm saying, don't do what you've been doing and you're good at.
Right. Yeah, right. So, yes, you have the access. The downside is there's so much noise out there, it's hard to get heard.
Yeah.
Like right now, we're having a lot of success in streaming, and we're developing an animated version of the Red Green Show.
Wow.
And when we launch, our huge advantage is that, you know, I've got 600,000 followers on Facebook, and I've got an audience that they want to know what I'm doing now. So no matter how good or bad the show is, I have a head start because I came up through the normal system. Starting from scratch right now, I love the access, but it would be very hard to get seen.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. This animated show, is it, are we going to hear Patrick McKenna on there? Is it the plan to bring the voices in from the Red Green Show?
Not him, but and we're great friends, but you know, it's really funny. I was saying to him the other day, you know, I created an old character that I would eventually grow into.
Right.
And for him, we created a young character that he would eventually grow out of. So, you know, he still shares in whatever we do. He owns a percentage of it just because that's the way we did things.
And nice.
So, yeah. But like Lumby, he was our sewage septic sucking guy. He's in. And Callahan, Ranger Gord, he's in. And Bob Bainbrough. And a bunch of new characters. Got like a 13-year-old kid, and we've got a couple of women in there. Kathy Greenwood doing the voices for that, and Ron Pardo's involved. And we started doing a podcast like 4 years ago, but I didn't want a normal podcast. I wanted a radio show. I wanted 100% scripted characters coming in and all that. And so we've been doing that, and it's so far subscription based only. I didn't want any advertisers or sponsors. I just didn't want them. But that's about to change because we've got a company out of Kansas that's taken the whole over.
That's fantastic.
it's cool.
So you had you've created more like an Allen's Alley kind of a show, radio show,
right? Right. I'm doing it with my son Dave too, so he's kind of co-hosting with me. It's been a lot of fun.
That's wonderful. Good for you. That sounds really cool. I have to get caught up on that. Now the other folks that were on the Red Green Show, those 300 episodes, you had beyond your sort of core cast,
right?
Some people just, I think, wasn't Don Heron came on as Charlie Farquharson once, didn't he?
Well, we had this segment where I wanted to make people honorary Lodge members, and Charlie has always been one of my favorites. Well, Don Heron, absolutely brilliant man. So he came on, and you know, it's a live audience, and you got to set up the next scene and everything. And between every scene, Don would just go out and start talking to the audience, and not as Charlie, this is Don, and just being hilarious. That guy is so sharp. So yeah. I was a big fan of his. Yeah, we had a few on there, Gordon Pinsent and Graham Greene. And it was really a lot of fun,
After a while, there people were just asking you to be on the show, right?
I was at the Geminis, and that's Graham Greene came over. I didn't even know him. And he said, what do I have to do to get on your show? And I said, well, I'm pretty sure you just did it.
He sure did. Now, how many networks was the Red Green Show on? It was a few, right?
Yeah, well, we started, you know, on CH and then Canadian Syndication, and then they had some financial difficulties and actually canceled the show, which was the greatest thing that ever happened to the show. It was their second season. They canceled the show, and I thought, okay, we thought this would be a six-month thing. We've already outlived what we... Anyway, I go down... I had a post office box, and I go down there to pick up my mail, and it was like a miracle on 34th Street. I go in, and the guy says, oh, yeah, I heard your mail. He hand me a handful of mail, and then I go out. As I got to the door, he said, oh, no, wait a minute. And I go back, and a huge box of mail, boom. I got 1,000 letters a day from people saying, do whatever you have to do to keep this show on the air. And so that was pretty encouraging. So then we went to Baton and YTV, because Baton had bought CFPL out of London and had to do some production to satisfy the CRTC. And so we were in London for a year. And then the next year, we didn't have a home at all. We just produced on our own. I mortgaged my house, and oh, my God, we bought the time on Global and sold ads ourselves. Oh, my God, that just about bankrupted me.
Wow.
And then season 5 and 6, Global picked up the show, and then season 7, we finally got. And every year we went to the CBC, every year for 6 years, and finally in the 7th year we got on. And I remember by then we had an audience, and I remember the live audience at CBC. The one guy asked me, he says, "How did you ever sell this show to a broadcaster?" I said, "I didn't. I sold you to an advertiser."
Wow! Exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, they're a little suspicious of shows which have a big audience at CBC. It's
against their mandate.
Thank God. But once you got there, it stuck, and you were there for like 10 years, right?
Yeah, 9 years. Slocko Klimku.
Right.
He's my hero. He's my hero.
Yep.
And yep. For 9 years, and never changed a word in a script. And then when it got... After our 7th season there, and we'd always meet at NatP and discuss what we're going to do. And I said to him, because he was okay for renewing the show, and I said, look, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to do two more seasons of the show, and then I want to call it quits. That'd be 300 episodes, 15 years. I'd be turning 65 or 60, I think it was. Something like that. 60, yeah.
Right.
I said, I know an off-ramp when I see one. And he said, Let's drop the contract. He gave me a 2-year contract. I mean, that's unheard of, you know, in my world anyway. So I could tell the whole crew, I could tell the whole cast, this is what we're doing. We could tie up storylines and character evolution, all that stuff. It was just, that meant a lot to me.
Well, he was a smart man, is a smart man, Slocko, and he knew that you had an audience. And he, as you say, all this mail, you know, and a membership. Keep your stick on the ice. We'll be back with Steve in a moment. second season of the compelling crime thriller Hidden Assets returns to Super Channel for its exclusive Canadian premiere on Sunday, February 11th at 9 p.m., with each episode also available on Super Channel On Demand. This Irish-Belgian-Canadian co-production is a must-watch for aficionados of crime thrillers. In season two of this Super Channel original, Criminal Asset Bureau's new team lead, Claire Wallace, finds herself at odds with CTU's Christian De Jong over the Antwerp investigation. And speaking of hidden assets, Quebecer and Brio TV favorite Karine Vanesse is among the Canadians on season two of this drama. And remember, Super Channel, an all-Canadian service, is available via most cable providers across the country, as well as streaming live and on demand with Amazon Prime Video channels, Apple TV Plus, and the Roku platform in Canada. Is again Steve Smith. I have family has a cottage up on the Bruce Peninsula, and the plumber up there it turned out was a big Red Green fan, and he told me that he had membership number 12 or something.
Early convert.
And he came to one of your live tapings, and you literally asked who had the earliest membership, and it was him, and he won the prize or something. But you know, all these people who were love the show and had Red's wardrobe and had a garage full of duct tape and made stuff and sent you stuff, right? That's so unique to have that connection, Steve. I mean, it must have blown you away at times.
Yeah, I really did. And, you know, I became really aware of it when I started touring. I did four North American tours, like one-man show, you know, stand-up more or less in the Red Green character. And the number of kids that would come to me, you know, like a 10-year-old kid, and this is 2019. You know, I said, you know, when you were born, the show wasn't even in production. And when I started doing the show, I don't think your dad was born. And they would say to me, this was the show I watched with my father. You know, there was it was a show the family could, they knew nothing was going to happen, that they're going to cringe. You know, the language is going to be okay, and then whatever we're doing, you know, it's a comfortable show.
It is. And, you know, looking through your book and being reminded of some of the humor, you know, let me start by congratulating you on having the courage and maturity to pick up this book. Whether you bought it for yourself or received it as a gift or borrowed it from a former friend or just reading it in the dark corner of a bookstore, hoping you won't be noticed, it shows you want to be a better person. Anyway, it goes on and on, but a lot of the humor, the husband and wife stuff is really funny and so identifiable. So how much credit goes to Marag, I think?
Oh, tons. Are you kidding me? This year, we're married on Remembrance Day, you know, in 1966. So this year will be our 58th anniversary.
Wow. Congrats. And, that's amazing. Good for you guys. Yeah.
The biggest, I mean, she's a great partner. Early on when we, nothing goes like this. I mean, you go up and down and it's a roller coaster. But anyway, one of the lower dips said to me, you just figure out what you want to do and we'll all get behind you. I mean, that was freedom, you know?
Wow. Yeah, that is amazing.
Yeah.
And what you wanted to do is create Possum Lodge near Port Asbestos.
And Mercury Creek.
Yeah, no, it's a tremendous legacy. Do you see any connection between the Red Green Show and Letterkenny?
I don't know Letterkenny.
Oh, okay. Wow. Okay. Well,
I know.
I was curious about that. It's a very specific central West Ontario show. The people talk in a cadence that is unique of that area. And it just seems that to me, I kind of see maybe that some connection to Red Green there, but you haven't seen it.
Maybe from their side, but I don't know.
Okay. And this idea that, you know, that you connected really well with the American fans who don't really know that much else about Canada, you know. So it was a more of a universal idea, Red Green, than specific neighborhood, wasn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of Americans thought we were doing the show in Minnesota. They didn't even know we were from Canada, you know. I mentioned branding before. I'm a big, big fan of branding. One of the things I would do is watch an NFL game on TV and see 100,000 people in the stands and think, if there's any red-green fans in that crowd or potential red-green fans. It felt to me like it was an accessible show to a whole lot of people.
Yeah.
That aren't necessarily being represented in LA or New York, you know, because you've got to be really, you have to be obviously smart to get an audience on the, or to get even a broadcaster to agree with you. When you're subtly smart and obviously stupid, they don't accept that. They don't see the intelligence in that, you know. So, anyway.
You see, I got it. I was subtly smart and obviously stupid. That was the
That's it. That's fine. That's me. That's my wheelhouse too.
Okay. Now, just besides the shows, you did a feature film with this character, which I went to see in the theater and really laughed. Wow. A book, and as you mentioned, you had a newspaper column. Do you remember newspapers, Steve?
Yeah, I do remember those. So do you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was in like 275 papers. That was a weird one because a cartoonist came to us and wanted to do a red-green cartoon strip, you know, those three-panel things.
Yeah.
And so I said, yeah, sure. So he wanted the script. So I wrote a little thing that would go three panels, and he drew the thing, and we submitted it to United Media in New York. At that time, they had the Charlie Brown comic strip, a bunch of other stuff, you know. And they came back and said, we don't like the cartoons, but we like the script. So then it was like, okay. So then we had a meeting with them, and they said, well, how about doing a byline, you know, for these papers? And so I did that, and I ended up, like I said, I think it was 275 papers. I think I did it for a couple of years. And what I was doing was just taking monologues that I'd already written in most cases, and I could just pare them down, fit them in, you know, certain, it was a word limit and so on. And but it was a lot of work, and it wasn't really any money, you know. And I was doing it just for the pride of having a newspaper call, you know. But ultimately, the whole thing, including all the PBS exposure and everything, became advertising for the brand way more than the financial immediate return of it.
Right.
You know, when I can go, we did sold out shows all over America because they were familiar with me from the PBS exposure.
Yeah. It was part of the culture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And is the show still seen on Roku, or where do you find the Red Green Show today?
There's a company in Kansas called Answer Media who approached us. Well, we've had a few of them approach us to do digital streaming. And all it ends up being is costs us money to create the technology that they want, the shows in the format they want, and then nothing happens. These people have been the exact opposite of that. They've done gangbusters. We're on a whole bunch of streaming services. If you buy a Samsung TV in Canada, there's a red green channel on it.
Wow.
And then they flew up and met with my two sons, who are kind of running the company now. And they just want to amalgamate everything. They want to take over the brand, amalgamate the website with the online store, with the streaming and merchandise. And it's fantastic. And that's what's encouraged us to develop this. And the podcast is part of under their wing now, too. But that's what's encouraged us to develop this animated series. It'll keep new content, will keep everything fresh, feeling fresher.
Yeah, what a great idea. That's fantastic. And just quickly about the character Red himself, were you drawing on anybody in particular? Were there folks, some of the sayings, you know, I'm pulling for you, we're all in this together, keep your stick on the ice, were they specifically from somebody or?
Well, you know, I did have a blue collar background. At the age of 10, I was helping the milkman. So, you know, we would have that great marquee. And when I went to university briefly, as a co-op program out of Waterloo. So in the 4 months that I was working, I worked in the maintenance department of a big factory in Galt. So I'm working with these guys. I pick up on how they talk and how they think and their attitudes and so on. So that all went in there. And I never felt above them, you know. I like I respected somebody who could fix something that I would have no idea how to fix. I don't think that's anything to look down on. You know, when my refrigerator's not working, I don't call a nuclear physicist. You know, I call a refrigeration guy.
Right. Yeah. No kidding. There's something about that slogan, Steve. I'm pulling for you. We're all in this together.
All this together.
You know, we're in an age where we need to hear those words. Like, it was very, it's all satire and fun, but it's empathy as well, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a warmth to the show. Yeah. And that was genuine. Most of those guys there, like, they, I should say, the core group, I mean, they were with me certainly all of the years at CBC and probably a few years before that. And I can't remember, in 300 episodes, I can't remember having an argument or even, you know, somebody speaking loudly. Then it's just everybody was there to do the best they could. They were having fun, you know, just good guys. I think if I met somebody who I thought was a great actor, but I thought was a pain in the butt, I would never hire him. I wouldn't hire him for his talent. You know, I was more interested in, I didn't want to hire bad actors either, but the number one for me was you got to be part of the team, you know?
Well, I've heard showrunners in the US, different people say to me that they're on their third or fourth show. And they basically, at that point, they have a no assholes policy.
Yeah.
And that really is everything at that point. Right. It makes a difference. So
here it is.
That's what we're all aiming for. Now, again, let's just mention that you're going to be coming to Hamilton for the Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame. They're having a February 21 to 25, all kinds of activities, lots of live comedy. Sean Majunder is doing one night and Ron James another, and you're going to be awesome there. Yeah. So it sounds like a great and an overdue celebration of what's a pretty impressive genre for Canadians, isn't it?
I think it's great. And you know, these guys, they create their own material, too. And that just doesn't happen on the drama side of things or even on the documentary side. I mean, comedy is music is the best comparison, you know. But even with music, you can have 10 hit records and play that, perform them for the rest of your life. You can't do that with comedy. Nobody wants to hear your greatest hits. You know, you
yeah.
gotta always be something. What are you thinking now? What are you saying now?
Yeah. You know, back in the day with Abbott and Costello, they could have those 12 vaudeville routines and have a 30-year career. But in the age of TikTok, and you're right, your 8 minutes, your 10 minutes goes immediately.
Yes.
It? Yeah. All right. Let's just get down then to the final three questions. What are you watching on TV now? Is there a show you're streaming that you love?
Well, you know, I find The Office very entertaining and sad all at the same time. I feel so bad for all those characters, even the good ones, you know, the Jim and Pam ones. I feel like, God, they're stuck in the, somebody's watching that who can totally relate to them, stuck in this horrible office, bureaucratic, arbitrary situation. But it's funny. So, I mean, that's something that I watch. And of course, Swamp People is one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah. Well, just on The Office, that note, you know, to me, a lot of great shows like Cheers were profoundly sad, really. I mean, these were guys in a bar. It was something else happening a lot of the time. So I think you're right. That's an interesting point.
Yeah, there's an undercurrent there a little bit.
Yeah. Did you stream any of the comedies? Ricky Gervais had that show, Afterlife. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I saw that. That was funny.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. Now, when you were growing up in Toronto, was there a show that you used to rush home from school to see or really love?
The show that I really enjoyed the most is probably the Steve Allen Show. You know, I wouldn't rush home. I'd rush home from school to see Wild Bill Hickok because I always felt sorry for Jingles Horse.
And you used to see that, Steve, on the Commander Tom show. They would show Wild Bill Hickok. Yeah, no, I remember I watched it as well. Commander Tom was one of those shows where they had a host who was a kiddie show, and he would show Roger Ramjet cartoons. But it was long enough that they had room for like a 22-minute sitcom.
Yeah.
And when they ran out of, serial space shows from the 30s, they'd throw on Police Squad with Broderick Crawford a kid being very
tenfall.
Right. Like, but I'd forgotten that Wild Bill Hickok was part of that mix. There you are. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Guy Madison, Andy Devine. Yeah. So, yeah. I think Steve Allen Show, Louis Nye, Bill Dana, Bon Knotts, these guys, it was just silly fun. And I just thought that is so great.
What a golden age, and you're right.
Yeah.
And now I'm a little bit younger than you, Steve, not much, but just enough that I don't, the Steve Allen thing, I only saw him a little bit later, but did you happen to, were you able to stay up late enough to see Jack Parr? Because I understand that was kind of a, one of those shows that made an impact as well.
Yeah, I remember Jack Parr. I have seen Jack Parr, but you know, Johnny Carson to me was so much better. I used to watch Johnny Carson in that afternoon game show, Who Do You Trust? I think it was called.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Yeah.
And the couple saying, do you have any traveling in, do you have any travel in mind? And they said, yes, we're going to California to get a son, get a little son. And he says, what are you going to call him? You know, it's just, I just thought it seemed so spontaneous to me. And then when he got the Tonight Show, I just thought he was a real combination of a funny guy, but a sincere guy too. So.
Yeah, very funny. All right. Yeah. Finally, what is your all-time favorite TV theme song?
You know, I like The Great American Hero, you know, Walking on Air and all that stuff, but I got to go with Cheers.
Yeah.
Everybody Knows Your Name and all that. I thought that was a pretty cool song.
It's pretty sweet. It was interesting. I don't know if you saw the Emmy Awards the other night, but they had In Memoriam, which was very well done. And they ended it with sort of a sad version of the Friends theme for the picture of Matthew Perry.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And it worked very effectively, I thought. Steve, it's a pleasure catching up. I'm looking forward to you coming to Hamilton for the Canadian Comedy Hall of Fame. And I'm sure a lot of fans will be there as well with duct tape and be thrilled to see you at that event. Congrats on this animated version of the Red Green Show. That's exciting. Keep me posted, please.
Yeah, I will.
Because you kind of swore at one point, this is it. I've done with Red. I've hung up the hat.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do this anymore. So it sounds like you've changed your mind there. You're still finding ways to have fun with that character, right?
Yeah, what I realized was it's not limiting at all. It's a great communicating. It's like saying I'm either going to sit in my room and say things out loud, or I can get on the internet and say things to the whole world. Which are the same things. Which would you prefer?
Well, you're right. Now you can do both over Zoom as you're doing right now. Listen, Steve. Best of everything. Great to see you again. And thank you so much for all the great laughs in so many different styles and media that have made me laugh for a long time. So thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Bill. Take care, my friend.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye. Thanks to our Hall of Fame producer here at Brio TV, Phil Hong. Give it up to BJ Del Conte, Paul Boudreau, and all the Crispy Critters, as well as piano man Stephen Dudley. Many years ago, recorded the music you hear on this podcast. Finally, thanks to you, listener. If you enjoyed this conversation, let us know with a like or a comment or a review, anything at all, any message at all. Here, and do it here, do it at Apple, do it at Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Bill Brio. Thanks for listening.